Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Thursday, the 30th and final day of April, welcome, 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 friends, on into the program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Hessian soldiers.
Yes, the Hessians.
Say that five times fast. Hessian soldiers. It's a difficult one for
it
me.
It is.
Or don't say it five times fast. Just listen to the program today where that term will come up many times because we're going to play back one of our Tavern Tour events. It took place last month, right?
Yeah, it
took place last month in New Jersey, and it was all about the Hessians, who were these German mercenaries who helped the British during the American Revolutionary War. I was actually not part of this event, but I heard it's a very interesting conversation. I will
for
hear
sure.
it for the first time today with all of you. Cherry, you were there along with EP Kevin McCory, and it was great, right?
It was a great event. We had a little packed room at the Barnesboro Inn in Sewell, New Jersey, and learned a lot. I had never heard of the Hessians before.
Okay.
So in preparing, I learned about these soldiers, where they came from, what they did while they were here, and we'll be talking about that on today's show.
Sounds great. It's also a DJ of the day.
It absolutely day, is.
Because it's a Thursday. We like to end our week with a song picked by one of you on the topic of that day's show.
So what,
gonna have to be creative, I think, this week because the topic is Hessian soldiers, mercenaries. Obviously, there's a Germany
Fighters.
Connection here. I don't know. But anyways, if you want to submit a song of the day to EP Kevin, you send that song submission to studio2@whyy.org before 12:30, and one of you will be our DJ of the day. Again, that's studio2@whyy.org. But first, a trio of local news stories. Start us off.
And hopefully you listened to Studio 2 yesterday, and if you didn't, here's some news. WHYY hosted a third district debate on Wednesday before a live audience. It was Studio 2's first ever political debate.
Whee!
Yay, right? The debate made headlines. Literally, it's on the front page of the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Philadelphia Daily News.
There it
because
is.
It was a great debate. But also
but also
because candidate Dr. Ayla Stanford decided just 2 hours before we were slated to go live that she would not participate. And if you don't know who she is, she's a physician here in the region known for her work during the pandemic and founding the Black Doctors Consortium and helping a lot of folks. But not going to lie, we were very disappointed that she did not show up, but we pushed forward. And we had a very fruitful conversation with State Senator Sharif Street and State Representative Chris Rabb. We talked about issues ranging from their top priorities if they were elected to Congress, to Democratic Party strategy, to foreign policy, to legalizing marijuana. And also we talked about health care, and we pressed them on some of the differences in their platforms and how they would see their individual roles in Congress. And I thought it was a fruitful debate. I don't know about you. What do you think was a high moment?
To be honest, it wasn't a moment. And I just have to be honest. I mean, the fact that one of the candidates did not show up overshadowed the entire debate. I do think it set the tenor for the debate.
Yeah.
And look, I'm reading between the lines a little bit, a lot of it. But you know, we had two candidates up there who are in real time trying to process the fact that maybe the race is changing before their eyes. And I do think they were a little reserved as a result, perhaps just because our format was so good.
Yes.
That it was such a civil conversation. But I do think that that affected the tenor of everything. You know, they're considering, where is Stanford in this race now? How do I approach this other person, given the fact that, you know, maybe the third candidate is not as big a factor anymore, right? And there's a lot of speculation in what I'm saying, but I do think that ultimately what it ended up being, which I thought was really helpful for the folks that listened and watched, was a pretty civil conversation.
Yeah.
There was not a whole lot of like, my candidate does, my opponent does this or my opponent does that. It was pretty much like,
Here are my beliefs,
and here's why I believe them.
And I have to say, we heard from a number of audience members after it was over who said they hadn't really been paying attention to this race, and last week was really one of the first times they kind of pulled their head out of the sand of life and really started focusing and doing their research in advance of May 19th, which is the primary election day. So I really do think this was a missed opportunity for Dr. Stanford, and I should mention that her campaign issued a a statement quoting her, saying that she was unable to reach terms with WHYY on format. Of course, we take issue with that because we really try to accommodate her and all the candidates in advance. And in the statement, Dr. Stanford also said that the race had been marred by, quote, misogynistic lies and attacks by her opponents. We did ask them about that. Mm-hmm. And they, of course, they said that they didn't have enough specificity as far as like what exactly they were accused of doing, and they both denied it. So I hope you check out that debate. It's on our YouTube channel, but we'll see how things shake out.
Yeah, and of course we have this platform. I'll just momentarily say that our team is super professional.
Yes,
and always negotiates in good faith.
Absolutely,
for every guest on every show, and I thought was incredible through this whole process. Mm-hmm. And folks can judge for themselves. They can watch that debate and they can ask themselves, was this a trap debate? Were we trying to create viral moments, or were we having a serious conversation in a serious forum? And you be the judge. You go watch it and you tell me. I can't be the judge of that. I just know our team is super professional and super competent.
And you know, we are people who, if you listen to the show, we try our best to be fair.
Yeah, absolutely.
And do our job. So
enough
story.
About us.
Second story.
Philadelphia school board is set to vote today on a facilities plan that would result in 17 schools closing. This is a rescheduled vote. It was originally supposed to take place last week. Well, why the delay? A big reason is community pushback and pushback from members of city council. In fact, members of council rallied this morning outside school district headquarters. There were 10 members there. That's a majority of the council members. According to the Inquirer, they issued a range of warnings and threats, including civil disobedience at tonight's school board meeting, maybe auditing the school district's finances, maybe even withholding money from the district if it indeed goes through with this facilities plan.
Yeah, very interesting. You know, I feel like people are taking these school closures very seriously, as they should. But I think something like this could turn up really, really quickly. So, you know, because I think the line between protest, civil disobedience, and violence and threats of school board members could be very thin. So hopefully this will not go there. You know, and I think, you know, I'm now back to the school district road. I know people are feeling very strongly about Lankanaw. That was a big one.
That's a high school.
That's a high school that is very unique.
It's set to close. Yeah.
Yeah, set to close. And so hopefully, you know, these threats will give council the leverage they need to hopefully negotiate with the school district. But I just hope that, you know, the council members keep the same type of energy, though, when people in the community come to them and they want to do civil disobedience as well, mm-hmm. or something that they believe in.
Yeah.
So, you know, mm-hmm. We'll see. This is getting really testy.
Absolutely. Not surprising. Closing schools is a very emotional issue. Mm-hmm. However, I would say this to the members of council who oppose the plan. If there's a school you want to save, then what's the school you want to close?
It's hard.
Or if you want to keep all the schools open, you're the ones that fund the school district. Give them more money to do that. Like, they have that power. The school district, if you don't know, here in Philadelphia,
they have to make a choice.
Does not raise its own money. It does not have taxing authority. It accepts money from the state and the school district and a little from the federal government. So if you want all the schools to stay open, I think it's pretty simple. Put a price tag on it.
Yeah.
City council.
Proud of the support.
Or if you don't want to do that, then, and you want one of the schools to stay open, then tell me which one should close.
Yeah.
And I haven't
seen
that.
And that's going to be a hard thing for them to do. That would be really, really hard for them to do.
It's really easy to say no to school closures. It's really hard to form a plan.
Yeah, it is. It is. Ooh. That's nice. Anyway.
Whatever.
This is a former city council.
The community members who are pushing back, I 100% understand that. No one wants their school to be closed. You should fight for your school. But they're not the ones with taxing authority.
That is true.
Council has taxing authority. They have money. They can do something about this. And I would love to see some seriousness about what they can do.
Yeah. Third story. Some Philadelphia restaurants are preparing to add a mandatory tip, a.k.a. a 20% service charge, to your bill during the World Cup games. Our story and Billy Penn lays it all out. Shout out to the reporters there. The Pennsylvania Restaurant and Lodging Association recommends that businesses consider this so-called hospitality fee as a way to deal with the flux of customers that are going to take over the city, many of whom are from cultures unaccustomed to tipping. The PRLA argues that Philly fans may approach a bar or restaurant and have a very different expectation than someone from Brazil or the Ivory Coast, for example. And in the U.S., you know, the standard tip is 20%, but it's much lower or non-existent in other cultures. Your thoughts, Avi Wolfenaren?
I'm fine with auto tip as long as you just disclose it and are clear about it. Don't try to sneak it in the bottom of the bill.
And then get a double tip.
But at the end of the day, I have a choice as a consumer. If you want to auto tip and your competitor doesn't, then I can make a choice.
Yeah. And they say that this takes the pressure off of servers who typically have to educate a table, and then it leads to conflict. So we don't want conflict. That's what they say.
Yeah. I don't have strong opinions on auto tipping, but just be clear about it.
Yeah.
That's all I'll say.
Don't have people double tipping. Okay. And we're going to talk about the Hessians coming up. And make sure you get your DJ of the day selections in by 12:30.
And if you're on YouTube,
hey,
we'll see ya.
Oh, yeah.
Rest you on the radio. You'll be right back here on Studio 2.
Studio 2 at WHYY.org for DJ of the day. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. To celebrate the signing of the Declaration of Independence 250 years ago, we've been traveling to taverns around our region that operated during the Revolution. They're old, they're often pretty small, and yet we've been able to pack in so much nuance and little-known history every time.
And this time around, executive producer Kevin McCrory and I went to the Barnesboro Inn in Sewell, New Jersey, to talk about the Hessians. Those are the German mercenaries sent here during the Revolutionary War to hold back colonial forces. The guests that joined us at Barnesboro made a shocking discovery. In 2022, a mass gravesite of Hessian soldiers slain at the Battle of Red Bank.
We're about to hear from Wade Katz, a historical archaeologist and president and principal of South River Heritage Consulting. The discussion also included Jen Janofsky, who is the director of Red Bank Battlefield Park in Gloucester County.
Now, it's been a while since many of us sat in a classroom learning about the Hessians. So to start, we asked Dr. Jen Janofsky the obvious question.
I know myself thinking about learning about the Revolutionary War when I was in elementary school, high school. You hear the word Hessians, you know, okay, yeah, German mercenaries, but I never really gave too much of a thought about who they really were and what the context was of why they were coming here and what were they doing in Germany. Could you just help us understand that context?
Sure, no problem. And so the Hessian soldiers are essentially auxiliary troops that the British hire because they simply don't have enough manpower to fight the war in North America. The Hessians are really remembered as the 18th century's premier fighting force. They traveled around the world for hire, fighting in different international conflicts. The name Hessian is a bit of a misnomer. They get the name Hessian because many of them were from the Hessian provinces, but essentially they come from all over the state of Germany and in many instances from around the world. In fact, there's even an Irishman who is fighting in the ranks of the Hessian soldiers. And so it's a really diverse group of individuals from a wide variety of backgrounds. You know, many of these soldiers who end up fighting with the Hessians are young men who don't really necessarily have an economic future in Germany. Perhaps they're a second or third born son, and so they don't have any financial opportunity, and so they're extremely limited in what they can do. And then there's also the professional officer corps who were exceptionally well-trained, intelligent, just at the top of their military game, many of whom were really interested in what was going on in North America. They considered themselves scientists and philosophers, and they were really interested in exploring the flora and fauna of North America. And so, you know, when we think about who these individuals were, it's not just the Hessians. It's a really interesting, diverse group of individuals.
And this is at a time when Germany isn't a unified country, right? There's different states of Germany. And there were a few, I guess, that were particularly attuned to making these sorts of deals and contracts. And as I understand it, it's not like the individuals were saying, I sign up for this. It was their state governments essentially saying, we made a contract to have a certain amount of soldiers go to the United States. And now we need to round up a certain amount of people. So how did that work?
Yeah, and so there's a different strategies that different areas use to be recruiting soldiers. And so, you know, in many situations, if you're in a small town in one of these German states, there are people who are more likely to be encouraged to sign up to leave town than others, if you know what I mean. And so maybe they're not fully employed, maybe they are a transient population. And so those individuals would be the ones strongly encouraged to sign up first. Individuals who had a job, who had a strong economic background, they weren't necessarily interested in recruiting those individuals because it would be economically detrimental to those communities. And so the individuals that they are taking off the streets many times were not particularly happy about being in this situation. And so when we think about battlefields, good guys, bad guys, who is the enemy, I think we really need to sort of complicate our understanding of who these individuals were.
And so how were they trained? Because they became known as this fighting force. So what kind of training did they undergo? Because they kind of came ready-made.
The Hessian forces are considered to be some of the most professional, one of the most professional armies in Europe at the time. So they are well-trained infantry formations that get sent here. A lot of the soldiers are long-term, 20 years or more of service.
Wow.
That's a difficult thing to replace if you lose that on a battlefield. You just don't have men that can fill in those positions. So what you see are formations that are extremely well-trained. They have been fighting across Europe for decades. The Hessian forces had fought for a variety of other kings and other localities during the other wars in Europe. So the unusual for them was to be sent to North America. They had been farmed out to, if you will, other principalities across Europe, but never across the Atlantic. That was a little unusual.
And so they come, they get farmed out. Wait, I'm using
that's fine.
Your word, farmed out to come to the Americas. What was that like for them? And tell us about the time frame, what was going on here on this side of the ocean that drew them here. Tell us the roundabout time frame.
So the first large division of Hessian soldiers arrives in August of 1776 as part of the first kind of large invasion wave that comes after the American forces have taken Boston and have pushed the British out of Boston in early 1776. We, the Americans, Patriots, occupy New York. And New York becomes the major campaign in August of 1776. And it's a massively large invasion force that arrives, including British and Hessian soldiers. But the Hessians are fighting as a separate division. They are not incorporated into the British forces. So you have a separate structure of Hessian officers and Hessian officer corps. You have a separate British structure of British officer corps.
And if you're a German, if you're a Hessian coming across and you're seeing America for the first time, what are you thinking when you see the colonies at that point?
It's so interesting. They don't understand what the Americans' problem is. They think they've got it great. Why are you revolting? You have an incredible country here and you're being treated quite fairly. And so they're really perplexed as to what the Americans' beef is with the crown. They're interested in exploring other German populations, you know, Germantown in Philadelphia. They're a bit disgusted by what they found, that they're not true Germans, because of course Germantown is exceptionally old Philadelphia community. And you know, they're really like sort of puzzled by what they're seeing. And it's really interesting to think about, particularly I think like younger soldiers, the long journey across the ocean, being on a boat for that long, the anticipation of getting here, and then seeing North America in a way that's quite different from their lived experience in Europe.
And I wonder, what was their reception like? How did the folks who were here in America view them coming over, these foreign mercenaries? How did they view them, Wade?
So the Hessians are viewed as an extremely dangerous, almost savage group of people. I think that's a contemporary term that would be used. You don't want to be anywhere around them. They will loot and pillage everything. They will assault your families. They will assault your women. They will do all the bad things that any mercenary does. And knowing the structure of the Hessian forces and knowing what the officer corps was, that's not necessarily true. It can be true in some cases. It's essentially the same that the you're seeing with the British forces is the way that they treat civilian populations is the same way that the Hessians are treating civilian populations.
And Jen, you mentioned that they were perplexed by what they saw because to them, the conditions in America were just that much better and people owned more land and had more space and had more rights?
Absolutely. This was not what their lived experience was like in, you know, the what we now call today Germany. And so they had a real difficult time wrapping their head around what exactly the problem was here. And they sort of viewed the Americans who were revolting, you know, as a bunch of complainers, essentially. Mm-hmm. You know, and just to jump back to what Wade was saying, how Americans perceived the Hessians, many of the Hessian soldiers had facial hair. And this was seen as something like extremely exotic. And, you know, if you think about the founding fathers, you know, none of them had facial hair. And they have these large whiskered faces and they have these really intimidating uniforms. And so even as Wade said, even if they're not, you know, pillaging and running through villages, they are this huge physical presence in American communities that feels very threatening.
I'm curious if part of what they were confused about it was like the aims of democracy itself. It's hard for us to think back on how foreign of a concept that was at the time. And was it something like they just couldn't see how that would actually play out?
I think what makes that a really interesting moment is that what the, and we shouldn't just say the Americans, right? Because obviously it's a mixed group of people. Some people are revolting, some are stuck in the middle, and some are staying loyal to the crown. Those who are revolting, I think it to us, it's just so accepted that what they were saying is just, that's our lived experience today, right? In modern America, that we have this democratic republic. But for what they were saying in 1776, it was revolutionary. It was unheard of. And so that's why it seems so untouchable for the Hessian soldiers to really like engage in those conversations.
Yeah, I wonder how they viewed slavery because, you know, you have this fight for independence, you have this fight for freedom, and yet the people who were fighting for freedom were keeping freedom from a class of people. Your thoughts on how these foreign soldiers viewed that?
Oh, absolutely. They were highly critical of the system of slavery in the United States. They were one of the first groups to point out how hypocritical it was that you're fighting for freedom, but yet you are enslavers. And the British Crown also brought this to the Americans' attention as well. And so they had a difficult time with that. In fact, there are individuals who were enslaved who end up fighting in the Hessian forces because that was an opportunity for freedom. And so we don't really think about the movement of peoples across lines in this type of situation. But you know, when there's an opportunity for freedom and it's there and it's right in front of you, certainly enslaved peoples took advantage of that.
Yeah. And I wonder, were there any efforts by the Patriots to sort of convince some of the Hessians to cross the line?
Yes, there are. Short answer is yes, there were. And there were efforts when you capture such a large number of soldiers at Trenton, for example, you are trying to recruit out of that over 900 men to see if any of them want to serve in the American ranks. There is a battalion out of Pennsylvania, which is a very large formation called the German Battalion, and it was made up of soldiers that came out of both Pennsylvania and Maryland, and they are actively recruiting any Hessian soldiers that want to be part of those formations. So pretty much any action that occurs, you will see attempts to recruit Hessian soldiers.
And quick follow-up, just because we've been doing a lot of these, a lot of the American soldiers were, I mean, a lot of them were still green because people, you know, they were farmers, people coming out, you know, out of the fields to actually be soldiers. So how did the Hessian skill compare to the American troops?
So there's at least one Hessian officer. He makes the comment that I think we have given the Americans too much time in which to become soldiers. Every time we meet them, they get a little better than they were the last time that we did this. So we are now, by that time, that's 1777. Like, had we won this war a year ago, we wouldn't be in this situation. But these men are getting increasingly better. And what you're seeing on the American side, the Patriot side, is the beginning of professionalization of the American Army.
Yeah. In our last event, we focused on what we called the disaffected, you know, the colonialists who didn't want to take a side and were kind of waiting to see which way the wind blew. Part of maybe what got people riled up and more into it was this idea of foreign mercenaries. And could you say more, I guess, about how like the Patriots were using that as like a rhetorical force to get people to be on their side?
They certainly use it as a recruiting tool to try to say that you need to defend your homes from the foreigners who are coming in to fight against you. from a perspective of the Hessians looking at the American forces too, and I think it's Johann Ewald, who is an outstanding chronicler of the period, and you'll run into him throughout the war. He's somewhat of the Forrest Gump of the American Revolution. I mean, the guy is everywhere. He's all over the place. And he makes the comment that there is no European army in the world that would stand and fight and do what it's doing when they haven't got decent clothes. And you haven't fed them for a long time, and they're not getting paid. He said, that doesn't happen in Europe. But that's what the American forces are doing. So there's a level of commitment to the republic and democracy that you don't see on the European side. That concept is totally foreign. Like, why would anybody fight like that?
Yeah. So was that the money, or what was the pride, or where was that
coming
from?
I think it's the knowledge of what it is you're fighting for and what that goal of independence is from the crown.
And so they had a purpose almost.
They have a different purpose.
A personal purpose. And so you talk about how the Hessians arrive in the Americas in August
76.
So walk us through some of the big battles that they participated in and contributed to.
So on the Atlantic seaboard, probably the principal engagements that you'll see the Hessian forces in, they are involved heavily in the Battle of Long Island. And so that's August of 76. Then they're involved at White Plains, which is a short period later. So these are all around the city of New York. The fall of Fort Washington is a major engagement that the Hessian forces are part of. And so Fort Washington, there are two fortifications that defend the Hudson River, Fort Washington on the New York side, Fort Lee on the New Jersey side. Fort Lee, New Jersey is still there, right? Mm-hmm. Americans have a massive number of soldiers in Fort Washington, and the Hessians storm it within a couple hours and seize it, and it's a disaster for the Americans. So lots of materiel and equipment are lost, and lots of soldiers are captured and put into prison camps. After that, you have the move through New Jersey, and the major engagement then becomes the Battle of Trenton, which is a real turning event within the Hessian forces there, where they are beginning to be viewed as not an invincible force, that they can be beaten. From the British perspective, they did not do a very good job.
And was that because of the surprise attack nature, or what went wrong from the Hessian point of view in Trenton?
There's a whole series of probably things that build on each other, but essentially the commanding officer may be somewhat arrogant about what it is that he's involved with and who's around him. The site itself is part of one of a series of isolated posts that you could essentially pick off, and that was the intent, was to try to, Washington wanted to pick off one of these and surround it and capture it. After that, the whole army pulls back, the Crown forces pull back to the New Brunswick area and abandon what some of you might call central New Jersey now, right?
Controversy.
But yeah, right. I don't want to bring that in. But they abandon the area around Trenton, Princeton, and move back to New Brunswick and Perth Amboy. But then the major movement is a fleet that the British put their forces on the Royal Navy fleet that goes down and eventually comes up the Chesapeake, land at Elk Neck in Maryland, and then march overland. And then you have a series of battles that are fought there, the biggest of which is Brandywine.
That was archaeologist Wade Katz and historian Jen Janofsky speaking before a live audience at the Barnesboro Inn in Sewell, New Jersey.
Coming up, we'll dig into Fort Mercer, where our guest discovered a mass grave of Hessian soldiers. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Ye Old Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aarons.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We're listening to our recent Barnesboro Inn event in Sewell, New Jersey, where we talked about the role of Hessian soldiers in the Revolutionary War. Kevin McCrory and I sat down with historical archaeologist Wade Katz and Jen Janofsky, who directs Red Bank Battlefield Park. They discovered a mass grave during a dig there in 2022. It included the bones of 15 Hessian casualties, of a 1777 battle at that site.
Our guests have traced the soldiers to our region now in Philadelphia and New Jersey. A series of pivotal battles is about to change things for the British and reveal quite a lot about the fighters on both sides.
I want to talk about Fort Mercer, which is only about 20 minutes from here, a little bit less. And I understand it wasn't necessarily built. It got built in 1777, is my understanding. So why did they build Fort Mercer and just sort of set us up? What was happening here before the Hessians got here and participated in the big battle?
So Philadelphia knew they were next. They knew the British are going to be coming for the rebel capital. And so they were going to make it extremely difficult. When they do come into Philadelphia, it's by land. It's not by the Delaware River. The Delaware River was inaccessible to them. And that's because there was a series of river fortifications and obstructions that the British could not break. And so Fort Mercer is constructed in 1777 in the spring. There's three river forts, Mercer on New Jersey side, Fort Mifflin on the Philadelphia side, and just south of Mercer on the Jersey side is Fort Billingsport. In addition to the three fortifications, there are these underwater river obstructions called chevaux de frise. These are
and
large.
What are they?
Yeah. Like imagine a telephone pole with a sharpened like edge to it sunk under the waterline. And so unsuspecting ships would run right into it and it would pierce the hull. And so you have the British Navy sort of chomping at the bit behind those obstructions, with the Pennsylvania Navy being a major pain in their neck, sort of taunting them and, you know, skirting in and out with like little improvised devices, making things challenging for them. And so these fortifications become super important to slowing the roll of the British in Philadelphia. Fort Mercer in the spring is constructed on the property of Quakers James and Anne Whitehall. These were people who were very financially successful. They were Quakers, so of course they were pacifists. So the idea that there is a fort 500 yards from their home is deeply, deeply offensive. And so they were not happy about this. They actually, the Americans take the raw material to build Fort Mercer from the Whitehall family. They had a lumber yard. They had a brick yard. And so this all becomes the raw material for Fort Mercer. Things are coming to a head in the fall of 1777. The British need supplies to get in by the river. And the first site that they turn their attention to is Fort Mercer on October 22nd, 1777.
Wow. And so get us set up. This is sort of the big battle that involved the Hessians, devastating to their ranks. Tell us about that day. Take us there, because it took less than an hour.
It was over in 45 minutes. And so, we should talk a little bit about who's defending Fort Mercer, because this is a really important part of the story. Defending the fort are the Rhode Island regiments, the 1st and 2nd Rhode Island regiments. And they're led by Colonel Christopher Green. And what's really remarkable about this group of men, it's this incredible moment in the American Revolution where you have African-American, Native American, and white soldiers fighting side by side in an integrated unit. And this really is like the paradox of the American Revolution, where you have people of color fighting for freedom when their country did not necessarily recognize them as free. And so they did not wait for emancipation. They took it in that moment. It's a really powerful thing to think about the experience that those men had defending Fort Mercer. They knew that there at some point an attack was coming. Fort Mercer was not necessarily physically complete. It's a little bit of a disaster of a fort from a construction perspective. It's too big. There's not enough men to defend it. They work with a French engineer to actually lop off about a third of it to make it more defensible. And this is the area where they're going to lure the attacking Hessian soldiers into a trap, essentially. Around 4 p.m., there's an exchange of words between the two parties. Colonel Emil von Donop is the leader of the Hessian party. He says, if you do not surrender, we will give no quarter, meaning they're not taking any prisoners. And Colonel Christopher Green says, we ask for no quarter. And that, to me, is an incredible moment. You know, he's saying, bring it on. We are ready for you, right?
Yeah.
And so around 4 p.m., the battle begins, and it is just complete chaos. Within the first opening volleys, the first few minutes of it, a number of the Hessian officers are hurt or dead on the battlefield, which leads to mass confusion. They hadn't necessarily done enough of their homework before they attacked the fort, so they weren't necessarily physically prepared for what they were going to find with Fort Mercer. And in 45 minutes, the battle is over, and it ends up being one of the worst loss of Hessian life in the American Revolution.
And give us some of the numbers, because they had a pretty formidable force, but within that 45 minutes, over 100 dead, hundreds more wounded, and they later died in the coming weeks. It was pretty bloody.
Yeah, so the most recent numbers we have worked with, and this is after we did the work where we uncovered the sets of human remains, the number killed on the day of the battle was 111 men. But then there's hundreds who are injured and wounded. And as those the following days progress, they are dying as well. The Hessians retreat and go back into Philadelphia, and they take any of the wounded they can back with them. But when you see the list of injuries that the wounded who came back into Philadelphia have, it's really horrific in what you see. You have people who are missing arms, people who are missing legs.
I'm curious what we know from, like, diary entries at the time or more historical records. Like, was there an attempt to write back to Germany and say, this isn't going well. Why are we here? We're dying. We're being amputated. Mm-hmm. It's just not worth it for us. Get us out of here.
So you do have a number of letters that are sent back after the engagement. One that sticks out to me is not the commanding officer of the formation, because von Donop is mortally wounded and killed, dies on the battlefield or a couple days after the battle. But one of the other battalion commanders writes back to the Landgrave in Hessen, and he says something to the effect of, like, I apologize that this letter is not going to be particularly well organized because I still am trying to come to grips with what just happened. Another says, I lost four or five of my best friends. These are people I've known, relatives and friends. This was a disaster. Within the ranks, it's a total disaster for the Hessian forces. They never go back into combat again after this. They go into New York Garrison, and they're in the New York Garrison until the end of the American Revolution.
How about back in Germany? Like, yeah. Are the families saying, yeah, this just isn't worth it, and maybe there's political pressure being built on the heads of state there? Or what's playing out in Germany?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And again, Dr. Robert Seelig is the person doing our research on this, and he's been in the Marburg archives. Because as our project has evolved, we've really started to talk about who did they leave behind? You know, who these are, fathers, brothers, sons, and what was it like for families in these communities to lose so many of these people? In one instance, it seems like maybe in one community, there could be a sort of media blackout. They're not necessarily publishing information in the newspapers about what's happening in North America, which is really interesting. But for most of those individuals, the communities, the families, they don't know that their loved ones died because for years, they never get word. And so there's just not the level of communication that there is today, you know, in modern warfare. Mm-hmm. When the boat came in and their husband, son, brother was not there, they finally figured it out. And so, you know, I think it's important when we, again, if we go back to this idea of who the enemy is, you know, and sort of think about the impact of those communities that with the experience, the tremendous loss, it's really horrific to think about.
And so when we look at this battle here at Red Bank and we talk about the losses, how does that battle fit within the context of the overall Revolutionary War? Like, was it a turning point? Was it just another battle? Like, how did it sit in the overall context?
Well, you know, it's funny, as somebody who administers a Revolutionary War battlefield site, when all of us get together from the various battlefields, we all think we have the most significant battle. Like, that's our job. Yeah, that's what we are paid to do,
it
to explain to you. Exactly. This is
the
most significant.
Point.
Exactly.
The pivot. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. But may I make the case for why it is a really significant moment?
Okay.
For a couple of reasons. Number one, you know, again, it really slowed the British roll. It's the only victory of the Philadelphia campaign. And so this is a real upset. This is, you know, John Adams wrote to Abigail, he said, now the world will take note because the world is watching. You know, like, we don't think about the revolution as a global conflict. And it 100% is. Spain is watching. The Netherlands is watching. France is watching. And everybody's sort of waiting for their moment to get their digs in on the British crown. And so this was a moment where the world said, hey, those Americans can fight. And this, you know, we're thinking more about, you know, being invested in this. It gives them time to get to Valley Forge. Valley Forge is their next major stop, mm-hmm. where there's a major reorganization and von Steuben is professionalizing the fighting force. And, you know, they're really trying to, you know, figure out their identity as this patriot fighting force. And so, you know, in my mind, it's significant. But above all else, it's that integrated fighting force. You know, I think people don't think about the role of Black soldiers in the American Revolution. And this was a significant significant one, and one that unfortunately over the years has literally been written out of the historical record. And it's not until the past 10 years that we've really dug into that story. Harry Schaefer is sitting right here, is one of our volunteers who's done tremendous research in this area, and we now share that story with our park visitors.
You didn't tell us you had a plant in the audience.
Harry's everywhere we are.
Shout out to Harry. I just wonder, and I want you to expand a little bit on that significance, because African Americans were part of this. You know, many people were enslaved, and they used the Revolutionary War as a chance to get freedom, and they fought on the side of the British. But this was African Americans fighting on the side of the Patriots. Mm-hmm. Just talk about the significance and how a lot of folks fought to keep that history as part of the revolutionary history.
Absolutely. So in the earliest days of writing the histories of the American Revolution in the early 1800s, white mainstream authors did not include that there was black participation at the battle. Interestingly, around the time of, you know, the abolitionist movements getting going in the 1830s and 40s, you have abolitionist black writers who are writing their own histories of the American Revolution to make sure that their stories are being documented. And in fact, in the 1840s and 50s, you actually have visitation from Philadelphia's Mother Bethel Church, the historic black community church, coming to Red Bank specifically to teach their children about black participation in that battle. And as they approach the American Civil War, it essentially becomes the rallying cry, remember the Battle of Red Bank. We fought at the Battle of Red Bank. And that comes up in the Civil War, in World War I, and World War II, of really the black community incubating that memory and making sure that story is being told.
I wondered how, because I was thinking about how this battle changed the context of the Revolutionary War. But I wonder, did this battle impact how people viewed the Hessians? They had a whole string of losses. Did this change their value?
They were already being called into question. And I think within the high command of the British forces, they're not seen as quite what we had been led to expect that they were going to be. Now, Hessian forces will still continue to fight in North America throughout the war. They will be sent down to Pensacola, Florida, and they'll be in Savannah, and they'll be in Charleston, and you'll see them throughout the Southern campaigns. But I don't know that by the time they reach those places that sense that they are untouchable and you can't beat them, Red Bank probably severely tarnished their reputation as a fighting force.
So if we fast forward to the end of the war, the big question becomes, what happens next for the Hessians? And some stay, some go. Could you help break that down for us?
Yeah, so about 5,000 or so end up staying. There was opportunities to recruit them to stay, to farm, and many of them settle in sort of like the Harrisburg area of Pennsylvania. Interestingly, there's a strong identity with the Hessian population in Central South Pennsylvania when they are talking about African-Americans fighting in the Civil War. And so they don't really remember the loss at Red Bank to African-American soldiers. You know, they said, you're crazy. That did not happen to our ancestors. And so there's a really interesting sort of remaking of memory there about what happened, you know, with the battle. And so, but many of them do return back to you know, the German states, and they go on to fight in the other conflicts. This is actually a pretty small blip in the universe of Hessians fighting, because Europe is constantly at war at this time. And so, you know, many of them are professional officers and military folks, and that's, you know, their life.
Yeah, for the ones that decided to stay, like, how were they absorbed into community? Were they looked at by the Patriots as, you know, enemies? Or were they eventually, they just became neighbors? Like, how did that transition happen?
My sense on it and what I have seen is that they aren't ostracized. They essentially are absorbed in the communities. Almost
they shave their beards? Yes, maybe.
And, well, but to some degree, it's the... you were misled, you know, you should join us, you were misled. And that's sort of the attitude that I think that Americans have adopted as to what this was. So we see them as, yes, you were against us, but once you realize what you were really fighting for, you wanted to be on our side.
So interesting. I want to fast forward now to just a few years ago, to a big archaeological dig that you all did near Red Bank Battlefield. Could you set us up? What started this work? And, of course, take us to the day where you made the huge discovery.
Yeah, sure. So in 2020, Red Bank Battlefield Park, which is a county-administered park, we're part of the Gloucester County Parks and Recreation System, was approached by a neighbor who was interested in selling a small one-quarter-acre parcel just to the northern boundary of the park. Literally, it was just a ratty old chain-link fence that was separating the properties, and for whatever reason, it was never incorporated into the main body of the park. So the county made the purchase, and in 2022, we decided to do an archaeological survey of that one-quarter-acre parcel, and I called Wade. Wade and I had worked together in 2014 on a battlefield survey of the park. And so it was a good opportunity to invite the public into the process of archaeology. When Wade and I had worked together previously, one of the things we noticed was how excited the public gets when there's archaeology happening in the park. It's like you're seeing history happening in real time. And so objects are coming out of the ground. People get to hold an object that hasn't been seen for 250 years. And that's public history magic. And so we created a public archaeology project. It was for 4 days. 100 people or so participated. So many people said to us, I couldn't sleep last night. I've been waiting for this moment all of my life. I wanted to be an archaeologist, and my dad talked me out of it, and I've regretted it ever since. And so people, you know, it's really incredible to see that energy and to see, like, that you are contributing something meaningful to our park's history. So we had a great run of, you know, public participation. The last day, June 22nd, were having a great day. It was the last day of the project. Wade was joking. The best things in an archaeology project happen on the last day. And at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, one of our volunteers who had considerable archaeology experience discreetly came to Wade and I and said, I think I found a bone.
Wow. Whoa. I got chills just in that moment.
Yeah, you and me both.
So, Wade, you got the word. Y'all got the word.
Well, and I am not a forensic anthropologist, so when I'm looking at that, I then contact other people that I know who can assist us with this, and we ended up asking for the New Jersey State Police forensics team to be involved in the excavations. They were able to confirm that these were indeed human, and what we had were four femurs next to each other. I would not have ever recommended to Jen that we do a public archaeology project if I knew what was going to be at the bottom of that ditch.
It's worth noting that we consult maps, we consult documentation. Yeah. This was an undocumented mass burial. Yeah. So the next phase of the project is what I joke is called what I didn't learn in graduate school, of how to navigate state bureaucracy, county bureaucracy, laws around human remains, and who can handle human remains. And so it was definitely a stressful couple of weeks.
Wow. And I just wonder, because you're on this battlefield, you don't know that these are Hessian, you don't know whose bones these are. Right. So how did you sort of say, okay, these are historic bones?
The historic mapping we have identifies any burial space that's drawn contemporary to the battle or soon after, well south of where we were. In theory, there should not have been anybody where we were. But the archaeological context of what we found is how we know what they were. They were 4.5 feet down in the ground in the old fortification ditch. So that was the reason we were looking in the space we were. The ditch is very obvious on this little quarter-acre parcel. You could tell where it was, the shallow kind of depression of the ditch. We reached the bottom of that ditch, and at about the bottom, maybe 5 to 6 inches of soil, that's when we began encountering human remains, and that's also where we encountered impacted lead musket balls, balls that had hit a target and had flattened out. You could look at that and go, like, those are lead musket balls. No, somebody recently was not shot by one of those and thrown into this ditch. Plus, you're not looking at a full skeleton. You're looking at pieces of skeletons.
So from knowing what you know just about history, you could tell right away that these were probably from Revolutionary era.
Right. And then the question is whether they're Hessian or they're Patriot. It doesn't seem likely that they are Patriot based on where they are on the battlefield. We know that the Patriots had 14 killed that day, but based on some other documentation we have, it seems likely that they were buried somewhere else, not in with the Hessian bodies.
So, Dr. Jen, you mentioned what I didn't learn in grad school. I can imagine, you know, being steeped in the books and the textbooks, et cetera, and then all of a sudden you're immersed in actual historical discovery. How did that change how you view your entire profession?
Wow. Well, it put me down the road of really loving archaeology. Like, I loved archaeology before. To me, it's not only a tool of public history to engage with people and to get people involved with the historical process, but on a very selfish level, I love the discovery too. You know, that's like, it's the best feeling in the world, knowing that something that you've just uncovered in a screen could potentially change the story that you're telling at a particular site.
Did it change the story?
It did change the story.
And how?
Yes. I think we were always doing a good job of telling the complicated story of the Hessian experience at Red Bank. But what this project has done is let us really dive deeper into the complexities of the revolution and who was fighting who and why they were fighting. And so it's really helping us bring a level of humanity to the enemy that I think is missing from a lot of conversations about the American Revolution. If we can move past the good guy, bad guy model, I mean, there's plenty of things the American patriots did that I think might fall into the category of bad guy, you know, if we think about it. You know, the American Navy, or the, I should say the Pennsylvania Navy, is firing bar shot and chain shot, essentially giant, you know, pieces of metal with two bars or two balls affixed to it that was designed to take down a ship's rigging, but they were using it against human beings. And so, you know, at Red Bank, we want to complicate people's understanding of that. When you go to a Revolutionary War battlefield, the expectation is you are going to hear a story of violence and pain and suffering. That's not necessarily the case. And we like to think that if you want to have a conversation like that, come to Red Bank battlefield and we can really dive deeper into this moment.
Yeah. And I'm sure a part of you is you teach, right? You started to feel a little bit like Indiana Jones in those scenes where he steps out the window and all of a sudden puts his hat on and flies away.
Maybe a little bit. I am an Indiana Jones fan, but he's a complicated archaeologist. Yeah. But I think, you know, one of the joys as an educator, though, is now bringing this into our classroom at Rowan University. And so coming out of this project is a field school that Wade and I teach every summer. So we have 15 students doing archaeology with the public. And many of you are here tonight. They've dug with us. Come dig with us this summer. We'll have 4 public days and get to work side by side with Wade and myself and a whole cast of archaeology rock stars. And also, you know, really emphasizing for our students that, you know, this is an opportunity to get outside of the classroom, get outside of the books, and get into the public and talk to people about the important role that archaeology plays and have meaningful conversations with the public about the complexities of this site.
And can we give, please, Wade Katz, archaeologist who helped lead the excavation of a mass grave of Hessian soldiers discovered in 2022, a round of applause, as well as Dr. Jen Donofsky, a historian at Rowan University, and director of Red Bank Battlefield Park. Thank you so much for your contributions.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
To today's conversation.
Thank you for coming out tonight. We appreciate that.
And I'll add my applause to that as well. The Hessians. How about it?
Yeah.
Learned a lot in that interview, Cherry Gregg.
Yeah. You know what? I wouldn't mind being part of a dig. I'm going to keep it real.
Really?
Yeah. Like, I like stuff like that. Yeah.
All right, folks, if you're out there and you're listening, you know there's a dig happening. Let's call
her
on it.
They're doing it this summer, so we'll see. I might show up. You never know. So we want to give a special thanks to the folks at the Barnesboro Inn in Sewell, New Jersey, and Robert Strauss, who assisted with research for this event. And, of course, thank you to the audience members who joined us to that evening. It was a tight space. We were kneecap to kneecap, but learned a lot.
Absolutely. I couldn't do a dig.
No, you don't think so?
Just not patient enough.
Oh.
That's my issue.
I just like being out there digging through dirt and like, you never know what you might find.
Well, we dug through the musical crates, or at least our listeners did. And it's time to reveal our Studio 2 DJ of the Day song selection. Al, hit it.
I took a little risk. Send lawyers, guns, and money. Dad, get me out of this.
All right, that's Lawyers, Guns, and Money from Warren Zevon, 1978.
Yeah, thank you to Pete S. from Westchester for choosing that song and for being our DJ of the day.
And thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel May Bryan, and Paige Marie Bessler. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. Send hoagies, pretzels, and water ice. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thanks so much for joining us.